Three messages before we get started. First, do you need a single phone number that comes with multiple extensions so anyone who works at your company can be reached no matter where they are? Go to grasshopper.com. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. Next, does anyone you know need a beautiful online store that actually increases sales but is easy to set up and manage? Send them to shopify.com. The platform that top online stores are running on right now. Finally, do you need a lawyer who actually understands the startup world that you and I live in? Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. I've known Scott Edward Walker for years, so tell him you're a friend of mine and he'll take good care of you. Here's the program. Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, and the place where founders come to tell the stories of how they built their businesses. In this interview, I want to find out how an engineer and painter launched the pioneering animation studio, Pixar. Alvy Ray Smith co-founded Pixar, the dominant animation studio whose beloved and profitable movies include Toy Story, Finding Nemo, and The Incredibles. In 2006, it was acquired for $7.4 billion by Disney, a company that its founders admired for years. But it all started in 1974 in a New York garage, as you'll hear in this interview. Alvy, welcome, and thanks for sharing the story.
Hi, happy to.
Where were you when you saw Toy Story, the first feature film that Pixar put out?
Well, I was in the audience of the premiere, the special showing for Pixar, of course.
Do you remember how you felt when you saw this dream that you worked so hard for up on the screen?
Total elation.
Yeah.
It took us 20 years, you know, from the first idea on Long Island in the mid 70s, took 20 years. It took Moore's law to increase by a factor of 10,000 is another way to put it.
And you were basically waiting it out, waiting for the hardware to be capable, the software to develop to the point where you needed to.
And to crack a few of the crucial algorithms like motion blur, which were fundamentally important.
Yeah, there's a great piece in David Price's book, Pixar Touch, which I use a lot to research you, where he talks about that and the significance of it. And I'll come back to it later on in this story. But before we started, you said, Andrew, the story of Pixar hasn't been told well. I'm wondering, what have other people gotten wrong about it?
Well, first of all, David Price's version is accurate. But I'm not sure how many people have read it. Also, Michael Rubin wrote a book called Droid Maker that has the story well told up to the spin out of Pixar from Lucasfilm. So you introduced it right. I like the way your style.
What do most people get wrong? The idea that Steve Jobs launched it and believed in it throughout and that it got essentially formed at that point?
Well, let's start right there. Steve Jobs wasn't part of the story for the first decade.
Right.
So, you know, the group now known as Pixar began on Long Island at this, working for our first patron, who was this amazingly interesting, shall I say, man, Alexander Scherer, Uncle Alex, we called him.
Really?
Uncle Alex. Uncle Alex was the first patron of three to jump over the cliff for us, and he was the only one of the three who lost everything. The other two became billionaires,
oh, wow.
The other two being George Lucas and Steve Jobs, of course. But Uncle Alex was the first one to say, we can use computers to make animated movies. And he put together a complete old-fashioned cell animation studio on Long Island, on the fabulous North Shore of Long Island, I should say, Great Gatsby Land, at his school, the New York Institute of Technology, which was really four estates on the North Shore, all cobbled together, and the mansions on those estates were the buildings of the campus. And we were in one of those. Not part of the school itself, academically, but there to, as he put it, speed up time, eventually deleting it. That's the way he spoke, by the way. No idea what he meant.
I still don't.
I don't either.
But he was a visionary. who wanted to see computers create feature films, to see computers create what we saw on the screen when we saw Toy Story. But I'm wondering why, as the founder of the New York Institute of Technology, he would want to be the next Disney.
You said it right. He did see himself as the next Disney. There's a strange association between New York Tech and Disney. There's a building on the campus, a mansion. You know, they're all mansions. One of the mansions is called the De Seversky House. De Seversky wrote, is a general who wrote Victory Through Air Power. It was an early book praising the idea of, the, of an Air Force instead of an army. Well, the Disney Corporation made one propaganda movie. A lot of people don't know about this. It's called Victory Through Air Power. It's based on De Seversky's book.
I see.
I think that might have been the associates. And since De Seversky was a close personal friend of Uncle Alex, I think that may have been where he got the idea that he could be a Disney. Again, his mind was impossible to fathom.
I see.
But he, you know, whatever the reasons, he put us, he built for us, he paid for us. We had the best lab in the world, the best computer graphics lab in the world. It was a mecca. Everybody came from all over the world to see this place. It was fantastic. It felt like we were in a dream every morning. We were on an estate. We worked in mansions. We never had to know where the money came from. We never knew where the money came from. He didn't let us know. But we got what we asked for. So, for example, we got the first 24-bit frame buffer, the first full-color frame buffer, you know, what's commonplace now, in your cell phone even, 24-bit memory. Then it was called a frame buffer. It was the size of a refrigerator and cost $1 million. So he bought us two because I just said that'd be a good idea.
Wow.
That's the way he worked.
Well, how fortunate to have that. But you know what? Fortunate is great, but how you ended up there is not just luck. I'm wondering how you, a guy who I think you were on the West Coast at the time, how do you end up going to New York and being a part of something like this instead of reading about it the way most people would and saying, boy, this is fantastic. One day this will happen. How do you become the guy who makes it happen?
Oh, that's a good question. Because the people who found their way to New York Tech just found their way. You know, it's like you started looking for where is this happening in the world and went to it. I was at Xerox Park, the famous Palo Alto Research Center, where the personal computer as we now know it, except they didn't have Skype yet, was being invented. You know, Xerox PARC had the first personal computer, the first Ethernet, the first mouse, the first Windows-based operating system, the laser printer, and color graphics is what I was doing with my buddy Dick Shalp. Dick Shalp had built the first paint program, a machine, the hardware and the software, of course, nothing could be purchased in those days, where an artist could paint on a computer. And that was what I was looking for, a way to combine my artistic skills with my programming skills. As soon as I saw it, I knew that was the future, and I never looked back.
And then you were just hunting for a place to help make this happen, and you didn't wait for an invitation, you didn't wait for a job opportunity.
There was a little bit of coercion. Xerox PARC fired me.
Because?
They called me in one day and said, they fired me. I said, why? They said, well, we've decided not to do color. I went, but the future is color. You own it completely, and they said, my boss said, that may be true, but the corporate decision is to go black and white. So I went by and went with my buddy David DeFrancisco, an artist I had palled up with for a National Endowment for the Arts grant, to find the next frame buffer. First, we went to Salt Lake, where the University of Utah famously had some great computer graphics people, where my future partner, Ed Catmull, would come from. And they said, they looked at us freaky looking artist guys. I had hair down to my small of my back, and David had hair, you know, out to there. And they looked at us, said, you know, we're Department of Defense funded. There's no way we can deal with you guys here. But there's this crazy man from Long Island who just came through. He has an animation studio and he wants to make movies. If I were you, somebody at Utah said, Martin Newell, in fact, I would get on the next plane, and that's pretty much what we did.
I see.
And we got there, and it was everything the guy, you know, everything that had been promised, including the next frame buffer, the next color graphics refrigerator. You know?
And Ed Catmull was there. He was already leading the operation.
Ed had been there a couple of months, I don't know, 3-4 months, something like that. He had been at University of Utah, and he wanted to be in animation too. He was an aficionado like I was. But he had given up hope that it... Okay, so his PhD advisor, Ivan Sutherland, was going to start, had started a company that was going to go to Hollywood and use computers to help make movies. Ed was waiting around for a job with Ivan in Hollywood. It never happened. The recession got it. But Ed had a family, a wife and kid. So he had to take a job. He took it in Boston at a CAD company, computer-aided design company called Applicon. About a month later, our famous Uncle Alex at New York Tech, was looking for somebody to run this set of equipment. He had just bought one of each at, you know, in Salt Lake. And I was told, well, you should look up this guy, Ed. He probably can't get him because he just had to take another job. But Ed left, of course, when he heard about this, and came to the fabulous North Shore and with his office mate, Malcolm Blanchard. So when David D. and I showed up from Xerox Park, we met Ed and Malcolm, who had just arrived from, you know, basically from Utah via Boston. And that we were the original four for the next 20 years.
Why didn't you stay there? Alexander Shore had the vision like you did to create an animation studio. In fact, he was already animating using, I think, cell technology, right? I mean,
He had the old-fashioned cell animation technology, where they actually draw the original paper, pencil on paper images, and then outline them in ink and fill in the colors tortuously with opaque paint. It's just, you know, it was the old-fashioned way. It was the way Disney did it until we came along.
Until Pixar digitized it for them.
But actually, we did it at Lucasfilm, but then Pixar finished the job.
So, but he had the same vision you did to computerize this, and he had the money to do it, but it wasn't a good fit because
he didn't have the skill. Now, he wanted to be the next Disney, and he had the, you know, a 100-plus man team of animation people to make a movie, and they did. They made Tubby the Tuba, which I'm sure you've never seen because it was pretty bad. In fact, we all went to sleep in the front row at the premiere in Manhattan because it was bad. He couldn't stand looking at it. It was a bad story. The animation was good. The old timers were really good animators, but the story was bad. The music was bad. The dialogue was bad.
You couldn't hire somebody to fix that?
There was lint on the frames.
It just wasn't.
Without anybody saying anything, we knew we had pinned our wagon, is it? Pinned our wagon to the wrong star, whatever the phrase is. And, for example, one of the young animators came, one of the few animators then who would talk to us, wasn't frightened of us, came up afterwards to me and said, you know, I've just wasted 2 years of my life. Uh-huh. He left immediately to work for Ralph Bakshi. And we realized this guy was not going to take us into the future. We had already had the vision by then that we were going to be the first people to make a digital movie. It happened on Long Island. And, this clearly wasn't the guy.
And so, before we talk about where you went next, the next of the three patrons, what did happen to Alexander Shore?
Well, he continued to run his school at New York Tech. He continued to have a computer graphics lab there. But essentially nothing serious ever came out of it.
And you say he went bankrupt. Was that from buying all that hardware?
He spent $15 million at the time, which is, I don't know, $50 million now on us, and drove the school into serious financial troubles. So far into trouble that his sons took it away from him.
I see.
Now, the school, by the way, is now a good functioning worldwide institution. I met the president, Ed Giuliano. He explained to me how close to the edge the computer graphics lab had driven the school. I said, I'm sorry, but we didn't know. We had no control over the money whatsoever.
No control even apparently over your own money. There's a piece in David Price's book where he says, you engineers wouldn't even cash your checks. You forget to cash the paychecks.
Oh, we never did anything but work. We didn't even want to go to sleep. We were having so much fun.
Because you're obsessed with this vision?
No, that sounds too fancy. It's like we were the first people to have full color graphics. It's hard to look back when that didn't exist, but we were the first there. We were on the land, a new continent for the first time. We got to pluck all the low-hanging fruit. We got to name everything. And everything we saw every moment of the day was new and exciting and thrilling and beautiful. It's hard to get it across how astonishingly amazing this time was. And we were living on an estate, working on an estate. I lived on David Rockefeller's wife's estate a couple of miles away. There were mansions there. It was, for a kid from New Mexico, this was quite a fantasy, but it was real.
All right, I can understand that. Now that you put it that way, absolutely, I could understand it. All right, and now there's an opportunity for you to go to the West Coast, and that comes up how?
Well, we always thought it would be Disney that would come rescue us. Ed and I always, for every year, he and I would make usually a secret trip, a pilgrimage to Disney in Burbank, assuming that one of these days they would take us. You know, they were the center. They were the great center of the great animation that we had grown up with and loved. And they were wealthy. It was well known that Disney had the money. And we were going to be an expensive proposition. We were a very expensive proposition. I hate to think how many hundreds of millions we cost our various patrons before we finally made it. But every year Disney would say no. I mean, I remember one of the first trips we went and I went on out there, they said, "Can you boys do Bubbles?" Yeah, we couldn't do Bubbles.
Why Bubbles?
Well, it didn't matter. Next year it was Smoke. You know, it was like they didn't get it. The computers can do anything eventually. It's one of those things you just have to know. We knew it. They didn't. Their technical people knew exactly who we were. And over the years, we made fast friends with the whole technical level of people at Disney, and it paid off handsomely later. But the management, one of the managers was a professional football player. Didn't have a clue what was going on. He had married Disney's daughter, was his qualification.
I see.
They were just driving the place into the ground. And the technical people knew that this was happening, and they knew we had a solution, but they couldn't convince them for many years that it was the right thing to do to go with us. So, who came along? This guy, George Lucas. We weren't expecting him at all. His first movie, Star Wars had just come out, flipped us all out. And when he did call, I should say, Francis Coppola called the day before George Lucas did. Their people did, not themselves, of course. But I didn't trust the team that called from Coppola's. In fact, they coked out a few years later, so it was a good call. But the next day, we got the call from Lucas's people. Lucas, in my opinion, Coppola is by far the greater director, but also flaky as far as financial things, up and down and up and down, make a fortune, lose a fortune. George Lucas is steady, slow and steady and competent. So it was a good bet to go with him, and that's what we did.
He seemed to also understand technology, though not as much as we thought he did.
He had used computers. It was part of their marketing of Star Wars that they used computers. And we thought, oh, okay. And in fact, there was a computer graphics sequence in the first Star Wars. It was black and white. I don't know whether you recall it or not. Our friend Larry Cuba did it. So we were, to us that meant this is a great director who's successful. He knows how to make a real motion picture as opposed to Uncle Alex. And he already knows about computer graphics. Surely that's why he wants us to come. Now, the wording was slightly different. The wording was, will you guys join us and digitize, bring the technology of Hollywood movie making, filmmaking into the future? It was stuck in the 40s level technology. Well, we said, sure, we can do that, but we also made content. We already had. I was already in the Museum of Modern Art, and we'd already done commercials on television, spot. We like to make things. In fact, David and I were there so we could satisfy our NEA grant to make art on this thing. We wanted to make content. George apparently didn't get that, but we didn't know it at the time.
In his mind, he was thinking that you would do... He didn't want you making content. I know one of the things he wanted you to do was to help him digitize his bookkeeping, like basically bring him into QuickBooks, which didn't exist at the time. But for filmmaking, what was it that he was looking for?
Well, he had a great vision there, actually. It wasn't exactly ours, but it was part of it. He wanted to digitize, for example, he wanted to make audio all digital. and audio editing digital.
I see.
Track of audio digital, which all makes sense, and we did it for him. Same thing with video. Film would just be the output. You do all your dailies and your editing with video under computer control. It makes perfect sense, and that's what, how it's done now.
Essentially, at the end of this interview, what someone will do here is digitally edit this, cut up the part of the conversation that we had before we started.
That idea, right? It's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and he had the money to pay for it.
I see.
Before it became commonplace.
I see.
So that was good. And the third thing he wanted to do, and this is where I come in, and the group now known as Pixar, he wanted to digitize the optical printer, which is the unsung hero of Hollywood. It's the machine that would composite one film strip over another. Rocket ship over a starfield, for example. And that machine was under computer control in the first movie. Not the same thing as computer-generated content. It was computer-controlled camera. Not the same thing. But that's what my group, the computer graphics group at Lucasfilm, built for him. We called it the Pixar Image Computer.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's
okay. Where that came from.
So even back then, it was called the Pixar Image Computer under Lucas.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, Steve Jobs hasn't shown up anywhere yet, right?
Right.
That's part of the story.
This is what some people think is the backstory, but this is maybe the middle of the story.
For the first film, and like I said, we'd already, by the time we finished Lucasfilm, we'd already been on the big screen. We'd already hired John Lasseter. We already had named the company. You know, we had done all. We had
done
everything.
Came from where? From you.
The name came from my background in New Mexico. I grew up in New Mexico, where Spanish is rampant, as everybody knows. At election time, especially, we're aware of this. I was enamored of this word laser because it's a noun that looks like a Spanish verb. Spanish verbs all end in IR, ER, or AR. So I got my team together to name, I think there were four of us all together in a burger joint to name the machine, not the company. And I said, you know, I want a name that's like laser. It's a noun, but it looks like a Spanish verb. And I proposed Pixar, P-I-X-E-R. And my colleague, Lauren Carpenter, says, you know, Albie, radar is this really high-tech sounding word, and it's got AR on the end. I said, that works too. That's one of the endings, Pixar.
And that's how it became Pixar.
From, yeah.
Under Lucas, the computer was named Pixar.
It was named Pixar.
Okay.
So and also, I should also add that we had a terrible reputation for not being able to name things. Our group had that terrible reputation. For example, we were called a placeholder name at Lucasfilm, the computer division. We all hated it. We wanted a sexy name like Industrial Light and Magic. So we, being a very collegiate group, set up a contest. If two people had agreed on a name, we would have gone for it. No two people. And we generated thousands of names. No two people could ever agree, and we got stuck with computer division.
And that was the official name. I actually didn't realize it was the official name until I saw it on Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's it. And so, you know, eventually when Ed and I got around to spinning out the company and I needed to send a document to the California Secretary of State to incorporate, it needed a name, right? We had been using placeholder like DIFIP, I remember it was one. That was D-I-F-I-P, you know, almost an acronym for digital film printer, which was okay. This beast move. So GFX was another name we used to hold the place. And finally, desperate, same group was trying to name the company. Same failure. No two people would agree. And finally, in desperation, I said, well, you know, there's this word that people already associate with our group, Pixar, that we could use. And the response was, okay.
<That's> okay. You know, Alvy, what I'm wondering is, again, under Lucas, you are trying to become the next Disney, not any individual person necessarily, but as a company. And again, under Lucas, you can't do it. Why don't you just say that's it?
Well, let me change your wording a little bit. We didn't see ourselves as the next Disney. We saw ourselves as the creators of the first digital movie. But it turns out that animation was the natural way to go to do that. But if there had been some other pathway to the first digital movie, we might have taken that instead. In fact, it can be argued that Rescuers Down Under, which was the first movie built on our system, the CAP system at Disney, was the first digital movie. But I don't call it that because the art was still created pencil on paper, whereas Toy Story had all the art created in the computer as well as the movie itself.
With the Rescuers Down Under, it was basically adding color, filling in, drawing within the lines.
Old fashioned cell animation technique, two-dimensional, but done, all of it done digitally, except for the original drawings. Of course, the exception there is the key, you know, everything, the art.
You know, I want to continue with the narrative, but first I've got to ask this, that I know that there are people who are listening to us who are struggling right now, who are saying to themselves, you know what, I've been working at this for a whole year and got no results. I'm going to keep at it. Or I've been working at this for 7 years, not seeing real results. I'm going to keep at it. And they're going to say, because Alvy Ray Smith kept at it for 20 years until he got to see Toy Story on the big screen, I am justified to stick with this, even if I'm not seeing my big results yet. What do you say to them?
Okay, that's a good a way you word it. It's a good way to word it, and I hadn't really focused in on what. If there had been no rewards between where we started and the movie 20 years later, I don't think I could have stuck to it, any of us. But I tried to express earlier how the world we were in was so exciting we couldn't go to sleep, and it remained that way for decades because everything we touched continued to be a first. It was so much fun. That's my largest message to you. We had a ball.
It was the fun of the process, and also it was along the way that felt rewarding.
You know, we were putting together this team of first class scientists was finding their way to our group. There were a lot of people wanted to make movies, it turns out. They would just find their way. So we had a world class group of people who were solving the technical problems that were required to solve for the future of movies, like motion, I mentioned earlier. Yeah,
because you were working on such a big mission and with a big brand name in this case, other people gravitated towards you and wanted to be part
of it. So I guess another way to say it is we were all really academics at heart. Our reward wasn't money. It was the fame you get from your colleagues. That's the pay in academia. And we had immense fame. Every year there's a big conference called SIGGRAPH. It's up to like 30,000-40,000 people a year now. It's where you would go once a year to show off what you had accomplished to your colleagues during the preceding year. The film night there could be the highest moment of your life. There'd be 5,000 of your colleagues all talking the talk, you know, who could do the technical stuff right down to the core. They didn't have to be told. If you showed something new to them that had never been done before, they would be on their feet screaming. An audience of 5,000 people screaming was quite a reward. Mm-hmm. So we would go for that.
I see.
And we would frequently get it because we had such a high-powered group. Every year, we would, you know, starting from 1980 on, Lucasfilm on, we would dominate the place. Again, it was like you said, the magic of Lucasfilm made it easy for me to acquire first-rate programmer.
You mentioned one of the challenges of motion blur. How do we explain that in this interview? What's an easy way to show people what that challenge was and how you guys overcame it?
If you don't have motion blur, the result is ugly. There was Ray Harryhausen was a famous filmmaker who, in the early days, made movies like Jason and the Argonauts where he had skeletons. But they were done with stop motion and they would jutter across the screen. It hurt to watch them move across the screen because they didn't do what a real camera sees. If you think about a real camera, its shutter is open for a finite amount of time. So if anything is moving during that finite amount of time, something in motion blurs across the frame in the direction of motion. So what we had to do was simulate that effect. That's why we call it motion blur, but in a very efficient way. It took a lot of computer horsepower, which we just simply didn't have in the early days. I emphasize the computers had to speed up by a factor of 10,000 during the 20 years to get from the idea to the execution of the idea.
John Lasseter, you mentioned him. He came into the picture how?
Ed and I, one of our many secret trips to Disney. We continued those trips even during our years at Lucasfilm. One day, we met a young animator there, John Lasseter. And he was young. He wasn't frightened of us. I mentioned earlier that these old animators on Long Island were scared to death of us. They thought, for sure, we're going to take their job away, no matter how. We thought, no, we don't do, we can't, computers can't do the art. We can take away the grunt work, but not the art. It doesn't work that way. John didn't have to be told that. He knew. He had already worked with a group and knew computers weren't scary. In fact, he saw the future, I think, and hitched his wagon to our star. There's the phrase. But he was working at Disney. We couldn't touch him. I'd like to tell my story about how we bonded, though. He took Ed and me down to the archives of Disney and said, well, what do you want to see? And I said, anything? He said, yeah, anything. Well, I was an old Preston Blair aficionado. I taught myself how to animate out of Preston Blair's famous dollar and a half how-to book. I said, I want to see Preston Blair's Dancing Hippos from Fantasia. John says, okay. And he walks over and, you know, looks up on a chart, and before long he has the manila envelope with the, you know, the manila folder, and he flips through the drawings like animators do.
Wow.
No Preston Blair drawings, and there they were, the Dancing Hippo. And then he said, now what? Wow. The elephant scene from Dumbo. It went on like that. It was just instant bonding. It was great. But we couldn't touch him.
So how did you know how talented he was?
Well, somebody told us, you know, somebody probably at Disney told us that he had been the Student Academy Award winner at CalArts. CalArts was the art school in Southern California built by Walt Disney to train animators for his own company. And John had gone through the classic training and been the best student there was. And I think we saw it. Frankly, I'm a little fuzzy on that, but we knew he was a first-rate animator. Then, and I'm sure he must have shared his Magi test with us. That was an early computer science company he worked with. Then a few months later, Ed's on the Queen Mary. The old Queen Mary is a convention center in Long Beach, California. And Ed was there, and we were having our daily business call. Ed was telling me, oh, I saw so-and-so, and I saw so-and-so, and oh, by the way, John Lasseter came by, and he's not working at Disney anymore. And I went, Ed! Get off the phone right now and go hire him. Yeah, that's a good idea. And he did. And John came. Now, what we didn't know is John had been fired. He was too embarrassed to tell us. And frankly, it wouldn't matter a whit, but he thought it would. And so he didn't tell us for years and years that he had been fired. Probably because, I think it was because he wanted to use computers and animation at Disney.
And he was the storyteller who kept Pixar from being like the New York Institute of Technology.
He was the guy. He was the talent. He was the missing ingredient. Raw, raging talent of the kind that he can't explain and I can't explain. I think it's the same kind of talent that great actors have. I'm convinced of it, that great animators and great actors have exactly the same skill. A great actor convinces you that he or she, his or her body is somebody else's.
Yeah.
To the extent that you buy it.
Yeah.
An animator convinces you that a stack of polygons is somebody completely different in his thinking and emoting and conscious, emotional. It's amazing. I thought I could do that. And it turned out all I could do, you know, I trained myself from Preston Blair's book, like I said, was I can make things move. Great. Convincingly. But that extra thing about putting a consciousness into the animation and emotion, having a clue. John can do that. That's why he gets the big movie star bucks. And he does. And by the way, Pixar does hire hire animators by how well they act.
Really?
So, I've talked to actors about this, like Brian Cox is a great Shakespearean and stage actor in New York, and I've talked to him about it. He said, oh yeah, that's exactly the same thing.
So then what am I thinking of? The next big step is that you need to leave Lucasfilm because of...
Well, before you get there, I'd like to... There's one really important thing, development, and I've mentioned it a couple of times. It was the CAPS project at Disney came along.
Right.
1 month after Eisner and Welles finally took over the company, it was, you know, failing under this bad management that we first encountered there. Roy Disney engineered the takeover of the company by Michael Eisner and Frank Welles. 1 month later, they knocked on our door and said, you know that thing you've always wanted to do with us, digitize the cell animation? Let's do it. It took me 18 months to negotiate it, or 16 months, excuse me, 16 months to negotiate it. They're really tough negotiators. But we negotiated this computer animation production system with Disney, which completely replaced their traditional system with a digital one, using Pixar image computers, by the way, as the horsepower. And why that's important is that was the bonding of the two companies. It was an incredibly successful project. It was one of those deals made in heaven where we outperformed what we contracted to do, and they did too. They had the, part of the contract was they supplied the logistics software at their end because they understood that a lot better than we did, of course. They overperformed on their end. We overperformed on our end. Came in sooner, cheaper, more larger set of features. There was a mutual admiration set up from right then and there that I'm sure what eventually resulted in the purchase of Pixar by Disney. I think waited so long is the big question to me. Because if you think about it, they could have had us for free in the early days. We were on our hands and knees at night out there every year. Are you guys ready yet? Then we'll come to the part soon here where Steve Jobs steps in to do the financing of Pixar. Could have been Disney.
It was $5 million.
$5 to $10 million, they could have had us. And then all those years when Steve tried to sell us for $50 million, they could have stepped in. They eventually paid $7.4 billion. It really doesn't make much sense, but that's the corporate world at work, I guess.
Do you feel that maybe if you were a negotiator the way that other corporate titans are, that you could have made Disney want it, but you were more of an artist and an engineer, and that's why you didn't have the ability to make them buy it?
You're probably right. I mean, Ed and I were not businessmen. I mean, none of this group were businessmen. We were all academics. It never even occurred to us to start a company. What finally made me start thinking about it was our colleague Jim Clark. You may know Jim Clark. He started Silicon Graphics, and then he started Netscape.
Yep.
He's one of my billionaire friends. And he was at New York Tech with us and got fired, by the way, by Uncle Alex in kind of a shady... We saw how litigious Uncle Alex could be. But we, more importantly... Oh, by the way, Jim and I grew up 60 miles apart. And I was in New Mexico and he was 60 miles away in Plainview, Texas. So we were homeboys together. Okay. Which doesn't matter. We've been friends because of that. When Ed and I finally do get around, I know there's a step missing in here, but when we get around to starting a company, I call my buddy Jim up and say, how do you do it? He says, oh, there's nothing to it. You can take about a year and you'll learn all the language and how to do it. Yeah. I think he was a little, had a higher opinion of our intelligence than we actually actually showed.
Or at least when it came to business.
How to do it, right? Yeah. No, what happened? Oh, there was one other thing before we left the Lucasfilm that's important.
Mm-hmm.
We just made the first movie then.
I'm sorry, that didn't come through.
We made the first movie at Lucasfilm.
What was that?
It was going to be called Monkey.
Okay.
About Monkey. It was this, there's a famous set of tales in Asia called The Journey to the West. They were tales of travel that built up around the journey of a Buddhist monk from China back to India to get the holy text of Buddhism to bring back to make Buddhism a fully fledged religion in China. And these tales are strange ones. There's hundreds or maybe thousands of them. And I have several sets of this Journey to the West, and they're each four volumes thick. The monk had companions on his trip. A monkey with superhero powers, pig, and a couple others. Okay. And the monkey, so kids in Asia are brought up with monkey stories. The monkey is a young person, really, with too much power. Because of his youth, he's always screwing up. Everything gets out of control. That's the general basis of all the stories. The character. So a Japanese company came to us, said, let's make the first movie about Monkey. Now, I already knew about Monkey. I had been to China in 78, and I was in love with Monkey, and the idea of that being the first animated movie was rather attractive to me. And we got a long ways on the negotiations to making that movie. John Lasseter was already doing the storyboards when I started running the numbers. Really, you know, it was starting to happen. So I said, well, it's about time. I better run the numbers and just find out what we're going to have to make a deal here one of these days. What's the number? What's the magic number? And it had to come out about 20 million or it wouldn't have made financial sense in those days. It came out at 50 million. I mean, this is just me not even, you know, just first pass is 50 million, which meant the real number was probably larger.
To make the film.
To make the film.
Wow.
And nobody ever made a film like this before. And suddenly it occurred to me, you know, this is one of those blinding, it's too soon. We've got to wait for Moore's Law 5 more years. It's too soon. And I had to pull the plug on that project. Again, Steve hadn't shown up in the picture at all yet. All right? All right, so he does show up here. Why? Because George Lucas got a divorce. George and Marsha Lucas divorced, and in California, half the fortune goes with each spouse. So I went into Ed, since we talked about everything, and I said, you know, George just lost half his fortune. He can't afford us anymore. He never really got us anyhow. Let's start a company. We're going to lose this world-class team, and it would be a sin, is the word I use, because I had grown up Southern Baptist, and Ed had grown up Mormon, and I knew he knew this word. So I said, okay. And literally, we went across the street to a bookstore in Marin County, California, and bought two each books on how to start companies.
Okay.
That was when that's when I called Jim Clark. That's when we started making the transition to businessmen. The weird thing is it worked. I mean, it almost didn't, but it did. And frankly, if we hadn't had such a weird money man as Steve Jobs, it wouldn't have worked. I don't think. He was, as far as money goes, he was great.
He just kept funding the business.
Yeah. But before Steve shows up, Ed and I went through every venture capitalist on Sand Hill Road, the fabled venture capital street in Palo Alto. We could get in their doors, which most entrepreneurs can't, because we were sexy. We were Lucasfilm, right? We were talking about movies and things. So all the venture capital firms would listen to us, and Ed and I got great exercise. You know, we were learning fast. We had to learn business from zero, from those books we bought. Learn how to present a company and talk financials and P&Ls and cash flow and all that stuff. And negotiation. Started learning the art of negotiation. But we didn't fit any of the VC formula. We were 40 people. We already had our prototype, the Pixar Image Computer. By the way, we knew we couldn't make the movie yet, right? I just figured that out. So what we're going to have to do, I remember Ed and I said, what are we going to do? We'll start a company, but what will it do? Okay. Software can't pay for 40 people, which is the size of my computer graphics group. It looks only hardware would pay for it. But we have a prototype piece of hardware called a Pixar Image Computer. Why don't we go into production with the prototype? That's just standard hardware business in Silicon Valley. And we'll just wait, you know, we'll make money that way and maintain the animation team and wait for Moore's Law to bring us the horsepower we need.
Throughout, you were making commercials. Why not become a commercial production company and wait for Moore's Law to allow you to move on to half-hour shows, and then from there progress?
We didn't do commercials until we were Pixar.
Oh, I thought you did even for at NYIT, no?
We did, but not for profit.
Okay. So
that's a not-for-profit institution, supposedly. So we just made them. It was just the fun of making it. We didn't make it for money. Uncle Alex may have, but I don't think so. It was just showing people what you could do. I mean, nobody had seen computers make anything in those days.
You know, because when it came to hardware, you guys were even talking to Siemens about acquiring the business to use the Pixar image computer for CAT scans, so doctors can look at scans in high-quality 3D view. It's just amazing to go.
Mm-hmm. After we failed on the VC front, we decided to go strategic partnership with some large corporation. These are all just standard business techniques.
I see.
For the company, right? And Lucasfilm, of course, is going to get a piece of this, so they're very interested in what happens, and they're helping. Well, they thought they were, anyhow. And so we went through, I don't know, 12, 15 corporations. You name some of them. Scanner, you know, print companies, scanning companies, Philips in the medical business, General Motors in the car design business, and that got very close. General Motors had a division called EDS, which was Electronic Data Systems, founded by Ross Perot. So this was the Ross Perot division of General Motors. And Philips medical division decided to team up and fund this startup company that Ed and I were talking. And it almost happened. It got to the point where 20 people around a giant boardroom in downtown Manhattan were all shaking their heads, yes. This is a done deal in business world. That's half attorneys. You know, there were four parties, Ed and me and our attorney, Lucasfilm and their attorney, Philips and their General Motors and their attorneys. You get that group of people saying, yes, it's a done deal. All you have to do is have the attorneys write up the paper and sign the documents. It's done. Not this time. Uptown in Manhattan on that very same day, Ross Perot was telling the board of directors they were a bunch of fools for having bought Hughes Tools for $5 billion or whatever it was. And that news broke the next morning in the Wall Street Journal, and instantly, overnight, anything that had to do with General Motors and Ross Perot was dead. It was our deal. So we were frantic. We were running out of time, and we had not been able to raise money from anybody. You know, I'd say there's 40 or 50 different ways of trying to cobble the money together had not worked. I should mention that somewhere in that process, Steve Jobs had, who knew about us, had been kicked out of Apple already, had suggested that he buy us. He had Ed and I come down to his Woodside mansion below San Francisco, and he proposed to us that day that he buy our division and run it. We said, nah, we want to run it ourselves, but we'll take your money. And he ran a number by, he said, okay. And he ran a number by Lucasfilm, but it was really low. And Lucasfilm just kissed him off because they had this General Motors. At about three times the money, at least twice and maybe three times the money, looking like it was a go on the table. So Steve was in there somewhere already. We knew that. I had a relationship with him already. So Ed and I, in our desperation, and in Lucasfilm's desperation, gave him a call and said, why don't you make that same offer again? We think they'll go for it this time. And he did, and they did. And that's how we got Pixar funded. Steve paid $5 million to Lucas. Well, the way it actually worked, he gave us two checks, each for $5 million. Us being the new company called Pixar. We turned the first $5 million around and handed it over to Lucasfilm to buy technology rights, exclusive technology rights, for all the technology that we had developed there. Exclusive, except Lucasfilm also got to use it. And then the other $5 million check was to fund the startup corporation. So Steve was our venture capitalist. And in return for his 5 million or 10 million, really, he got 70% of the company, and the employees got 30%.
Not for long.
Not for long, but I do object when I hear people say, Steve bought the company from Lucasfilm. No, he didn't. He did a standard spin-out. He financed a standard corporation spin-out from another corporation.
Like an LBO or a management buyout, it seems like, with an investor who owns 70-plus percent.
Just the venture capitalist stepped in with the money. LBO is usually done with debt, isn't it?
Right, right.
Yeah, this is not debt. This is equity. I mean, this is equity capital.
But in your mind, he was not. You definitely didn't. You didn't want him to run the company. You said no when that's what he wanted. In your mind, he was just the money, the venture capitalist.
Money. By this time, he was running his own company called Next, the next company after Apple, of course. An hour and a half away, we were in Marin County, above San Francisco, and he was in Mountain View, below, an hour and a half away below San Francisco, and. Our management style, Ed and me, our management style was to keep him out of the building. We would always hold the board meeting. So he and Ed and I were the board of directors. And we quickly learned that if he ever entered our building, it would take about a week or two to get it all back into reality.
What do you mean? How did you personally feel about him back then?
Well, he was a magic character. I think everybody knows that. When he starts talking, he's irresistible. You know, he just weaves this web of magic words, and for long, everybody's going, oh.
Like what? What did he make people feel?
Well, he would paint a story. It was usually baloney, which is why I had trouble with him. But people would just believe whatever it was that he was spilling out of his mouth. Some picture of what the
hell. For example?
Well, what he would do, here's a for example in our place that would confuse things, is we were building a piece of hardware, right? The Pixar image computer. Mm-hmm. Steve would come in, and the employees would come together, and he'd give a talk, and he would have them believing that they could turn out a board in a month that they knew good and well, I mean in a week, that they knew good and well would take a month. But he'd have them convinced. And, so, and by the way, I would watch my employees look at Steve, and they would have this look of love in their eyes. I mean, he was so charismatic, he would just grab them. But I also noticed that he was just pouring junk into their minds. And so what we'd have to do when he'd leave was go around and say, they'd say, I'm going to turn this out in a week. I said, you can turn it out in a week. No. Well, get back to reality. What's it going to take?
What would happen if they tried to get it out in a week because Steve Jobs, it just wasn't going to happen?
It wouldn't happen. It just wouldn't happen. I mean, these things just take their time. You can't rush them. In fact, when you rush detailed engineering things, you're going to screw them up, probably.
So if he was the reality distortion field...
That's a great word. That's exactly what it was. It was complete reality distortion.
Even of the two of you, were you...
Better, but once he had told them they could do it faster, they would just say they could. They couldn't.
And then were you supposed to be, not Ed, but you, Alvy, supposed to be the reality restoration field?
And both of us. That's what we would do. I'd go around and say, no. That's not how it works.
I see. Don't be upset at your people because they couldn't get it done. You're supposed to tell people internally, don't be upset at the team because they can't get it done in a week. This will take a month. It might even take longer. That's just the way it is.
The way we do it is, you're the expert engineer, hardware designer engineer. You tell us what it takes. And they would say, and they could maybe squeeze an extra day out or something under pressure, but not 3 weeks. That was unreal.
I've heard entrepreneurs here talk about the tantrums that they've seen him have, the crying sessions one entrepreneur talked about. Did you see any of that with him?
No, you have to remember, he was not there. He was at Next. He would show up. He maybe showed up once a year or something, for the first several years. I mean, our technique was not to, think of any excuse we can not to have him in the building.
I see.
For example, to always hold the board meetings at Next, not at Pixar. And he would try to get us to move the company. He'd say, why don't you move the company down, closer to him is what it was. We'd all come up with some reason that was absolutely impossible. John Lasseter was living in Sonoma. It was too big a load. No way we were going to move the company closer to him. He was just too disruptive.
And he kept putting in money, kept funding the business, even when it was losing money, he kept at it. But at one point, and we kind of mentioned this earlier, there was a breaking point where he said, hey, you know what? I'm putting in all this money. Why do the employees still have a big share of this company? And he did what?
Well, it was much more gradual than that.
It was?
As a company, frankly, we should have failed 3, 4, 5 times. We got to the point where we couldn't pay the bills. That's failure. We had one thing on our side that startups, the usual startup, doesn't have. Steve was too embarrassed after having been booted out of Apple to be seen as a failure on his first investment.
I see.
So in order to avoid the embarrassment, he would write a check, he would tear Edamy apart, and he would take equity away from the employees. All makes sense, but except for the fact that he was, you know, we should have failed. We couldn't pay the bills. I emphasize it wasn't because he had this great vision for the future and he was just holding in. It was embarrassment.
I see.
And then it happened again and again and again. He kept writing the checks until he was in up to $50 million and had taken all the equity away. So in a way, he bought the company from the employees, if you want to have him buying it from somebody. But it was a slow process of many, many different contracts over several years. At $50 million, I think that was half of what he had made at Apple. So he was, a big chunk of his fortune was, and not looking good, right? The hardware business was really not working. It was a great machine. It was a supercomputer for image processing, but only Disney was buying them, and a few 3, 4, or 5 letter agencies from Washington who wouldn't tell us what they were doing with them. but it just wasn't working as a company. What happened was, meanwhile, we kept the animation team there, of course, that was the whole idea. And they started putting out commercials. You know, we tried all sorts of projects, making software, making commercials and stuff to keep it alive, but it just wasn't working. But Moore's Law was cranking along in the background all this time. The next 5 years passed. You know, maybe it's 3 years or 4 years. You know, the next chunk passed. And Disney knocked on our door again and said, okay, let's make the movie. And so we started making Toy Story.
And they said, you make the movie for us. You write it, but we have the ability
market and distribute it. You make it. So we produced it. We designed it and produced it. And they would market it and distribute it.
Why did you leave?
Well, I want to finish with this.
Oh, go for it.
Because it's important. Again, I'm trying to get the facts back into position here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did I say Steve Jobs had the idea of Toy Story? No, he didn't. Disney came to us and said, let's make the movie, and John designed it. Ed negotiated it. Okay? And, in fact, I was about to leave during this period, but I stayed there long enough to be sure that the Toy Story deal happened. And there was a problem. Remember I said that John Lasseter had been fired by Disney?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to work with them. Ed and I were frantic, you know, here was the big break. Here was what we've been waiting for all these years, preparing for, waiting for Moore's Law for. It's about to happen. John, our head animator, you know, the chief artist, didn't want to work with him. So a meeting was called by Jeffrey Katzenberg in Burbank, who was head of animation at Disney. At that meeting, so Ed and I and John and I think Bill Reeves, who's a technical equivalent to John, and Steve, who wanted to meet this guy, Katzenberg, all went down to this meeting. And Jeffrey Katzenberg turns out to be a lot like Steve Jobs. He's charismatic. He weaves this magic web of words. And before long, everybody's going, boom. And he was very explicit. He said, I tried to hire John Lasseter away from you, and he won't leave. For in order to work with him, I'm going to work with you. John thinks I'm a tyrant, and I am. But I want you to know that if you have a better idea than I have, John, I want you, John, to know that you have a better idea than I have. You can convince me, but you better be right. And then the meeting turned loose. So the big boys went out of the room, you know, Jobs and Katzenberg. And the idea was that John and the technical lead, Bill Reeves, would spend time with directors and animators at Disney, asking them what it was like to actually work on a movie with Katzenberg at the top. That's what happened. So for several hours, we just hung out. At the end of the day, I'm walking back toward the car, the rental car, to go back to Northern California. John and I are out in front of everybody else, and I turned to him and said, "What do you think?" He says, "I can do it." And that was the moment I went, okay, this is going to happen, right? This is going to happen. And I started putting together an exit strategy.
And here you were, like Moses, shepherding your people to the promised land. You're finally right there at the border. And
I hadn't thought about that comparison.
They cross, but you don't.
Firing that.
You don't have a big staff either.
Oh, I do. It's in the next room. So why? Did I not go on into the promised land? Because I wanted Steve Jobs out of my life. He and I had a terrible face-off. And I saw his true colors, and I didn't want that guy in my life anymore. And so I came up with another startup idea and spun it out. My joke is I sold my first company to Steve Jobs and my second company to Bill Gates, because that's what happened. Guess who one of the financiers was for my second company?
Oh, Steve Autodesk.
Steve Jobs.
How do you mean?
Pixar, which was Steve Jobs at that point, owned 10% of my second company.
I didn't know that.
Again, Steve Jobs came through for financing, but was sort of a horror show as a person.
So you wanted out of your life. You didn't want to managing your world anymore. You started your company, but you needed funding, so you went to Autodesk, the software giant.
Autodesk was the seed capital, and the way it was, the deal was originally formulated. I would pay a $25 royalty on every piece of software to Pixar. That's an unworkable scheme. So when I went to second round financing, it turned into a 10% ownership by Pixar.
I see. Okay. How much did you sell your company to Microsoft for?
I think it was $6.5 million. But wow. What made it sweet was I was paid in Microsoft stock, which split 16 times. I mean, split by a factor of 16 over the next several years while I was investing.
And it was fantastic years for Microsoft.
It was fantastic.
Fantastic.
It was I've had many strokes of luck in life, but that was one of the sweetest ones.
And then you went on to become their first graphics fellow. So it seems like it was a perfect life at that point. Maybe there's nothing perfect, but it seemed like it was a really good life then.
Yeah. If it hadn't been for Steve, I'm sure I would have stayed at Pixar.
And so was it bittersweet to see Toy Story up on the screen? Sweet because...
Oh, it was wonderful. It wasn't bitter. It was just sweet all the way. It was wonderful. It happened. It really happened. Fantastic. And by the way, so let's go back to Toy Story, because this is also part of the Steve Jobs thing. So we made Toy Story. Pixar, I'm leaving after the first part of it, while it was being negotiated. So Pixar made Toy Story. Ed's running the company. It's taken to, as it nears completion, it's taken to by Disney to New York, where the critics see it and they go bananas. And they inform us that it's going to be a huge hit. This is the point where Steve Jobs rushed in, pushed Ed aside as CEO, and took over leadership of Pixar, so he was there when the cameras rolled. It's really Ed Catmull who ran Pixar all the time, always. And I think it's underappreciated, that fact. It was he who ran the company. He was our leader from the early days out on Long Island through Lucasfilm, through Pixar, and still runs Pixar. Now, there was this office of the president baloney so that Steve could be there too, but that was part of Steve's marketing campaign. But again, in fairness to Steve, because, you know, financially and business-wise, he was fantastic. He was a scary negotiator. So when really important deals needed to be made, put Steve in the room. Man, things happened. And he had this brilliant move, which was to take Pixar public on nothing except the probability that this movie is going to be a big success. That was a gutsy move. And he turned his $50 million into $1 billion overnight by that move. Kudos. And he should get all those kind of kudos, you know, financial and business kudos. But when it comes to vision and naming and look and feel and why he funded the company, so that's all malarkey, you know. That's just a marketing story.
The sense that Pixar shows his taste, that's not true. He wasn't...
He liked what we did shows his taste, but the taste that we show is not his. It's John Lasseter's.
Yeah.
And Brad Bird's and the other talent that John has pulled in.
And still, there's
a difficult story there. You know, the guy's incredibly important to us. There's just no way around that. That's for sure. And I thank him highly for it, for, you know, supporting us through thick and thin, even though it was torture a lot of the time. But I do get upset when people start making him the inventor of it all, and that the movies were his idea, and the name even came from him. And, you know, that's just malarkey. He was a great marketer.
He was a great marketer.
Great marketer. And his self-marketing, his marketing of himself was first rate. Well, he even got the biographer of Einstein to do his biography.
What did you think of the book?
I was worried about it. Walter Isaacson called me early on, and I said, oh, I've been expecting you. And he says, you have? And I said, well, sure. If you're doing your history right, you've got to call me, right? I said, I think this idea stinks. Here's one of the world's great marketers hiring the biographer of Einstein to write his own biography. That stinks. And Walter said, oh, that's not what happened. That's my idea. Turns out not to be true. It was Steve's idea. But he didn't let Steve have editorial control over the book. That was the right thing. And so the content is what I was measured. In particular, he represents me accurately. The face-off, the famous whiteboard face-off, is accurately presented. And he calls me the co-founder of Pixar in the opening pages, which is true. You know, basically, Steve has denied me that credit over all the years.
He has, but as I see online, no one else seems to have. I was looking for a place to show you, aha, Wikipedia left you out. How upset are you with that?
Well, look at Pixar's website.
Let's take a look now. I know that when Steve Jobs died, you weren't on the homepage. It was like three co-founders started this company together, Steve Jobs, Ed, and John. And
no, only Ed is a co-founder of Pixar. I'm the other co-founder. John was there at the beginning, that's for sure. And Steve was the money, and the money is never a co-founder. That would make Andy Bechtolstein a founder of Google, which he's not.
Here, let's go to the About page.
My second company, which it's not.
There, here's the photo that I'm looking at. This, our story, a picture of
The three. It's not loading. That's the marketing. That's the marketing story. The history books are turning right now. Isaacson helped. David Price's book has it right. Michael Rubin's book has it right. It will out, but it's not been fun to have. You know, clearly. He didn't want me in the picture anymore because we didn't like each other a lot.
What? How was he? Was he personal in his attacks on you?
Oh, my God, yes. He was a bully of the first order. It was just a street yard bully.
What kind of personal attacks would he make?
Well, the famous one is the one in the Isaacson book about the whiteboard where I guess I should tell you that he and I always... I always backtalk to him because he would always, his style, the way Steve would start up, is this the kind of stuff you like to hear? Steve Jobs is such an interesting guy. It's fun to tell the stories. He would, the way he had techniques for grabbing attention at a meeting. His one technique was he would walk into a room and he would say something so outrageous that everybody's mouth would drop, and in that moment he would take the agenda and it would become his meeting. So we quickly learned to ignore the first statement out of his mouth. Just let it go by and then start the meeting.
I see.
Okay. Another thing we would do, these are board meetings I'm talking about usually. Another thing we learned was when his charisma would grab your colleague, we had signs.
I see.
He's got you.
He's in the field. You're in the field.
Yes, you're in the field. Get back to the agenda. I forgot where we were headed with that.
Just the way that he would attack and be personal. Oh, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
So, you don't seem bitter about it is why I say it. You give him credit for the things that he did. You're not bitter.
I'm trying to be just as straight and honest about what really happened, but not deny myself the credit I think I deserve. So I basically trust in history and to get it right, but it does have to be addressed. You know?
It does seem like history, well, from what I can see, but maybe I've been looking at it more carefully than most, where it matters, it seems like history is right.
Say bad things about Steve Jobs. People so much want him to be their hero. This is sort of the amazing thing about the humans, I guess, is we want our heroes. And he painted himself beautifully into this great hero of the modern world. And maybe it's all true at Apple. I don't know. I rather doubt it because I know what he was like at Pixar. But I knew the guy, and I know what I know. So he wasn't a hero. But people who don't want to hear that write nasty things to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They just deny what I sell them is the truth. Yeah.
And by the way, now as we talk, I'm looking at the Steve Jobs book on my Kindle, but I should put that away. And coming back to your story, when you retired, what did you end up doing? What was the one thing that you said that you were looking forward to that you actually got to do at the end of all this?
Well, there were several things. One is I wanted to, the digital camera had finally arrived. We knew it. We told Kodak back decades ago, what are you going to do when you run out of, when film goes away? And they would, that's not going to happen. There will always be a need for film. We knew better. It's just Moore's Law again. This was going to happen. And finally it happened in about 2000. I think the Nikon D1 came out and I flipped out. This was finally a professional quality digital camera. So I, spent my first year of retired freedom taking pictures, going to Africa. It was fantastic. Just quickly, Now everybody does it, but I got to be there first.
It's amazing how many people in technology who are visionaries, who are the people who create who create the future, don't see parts of the future. You talked earlier about Xerox not seeing color. And you know what? I understand why they didn't. They said, what businesses are buying our stuff? What business wants to mess around with color? They just want the facts on paper. We can't get into color, right?
I have a different view now about Xerox than I had as a young Turk. I've sat on the other side of the table now as the young Turks come to me with thousands of great ideas. And, running a company, you just have to prune the tree. You have to stick with core competencies, as they say. What was the core competency at Xerox? It was black and white. Paper stuff, right? What did they stick with? They stuck with the laser printer. Mm-hmm. It may have been a really smart thing. They still exist. They're still very successful. Xerox PARC even still exists. I went to the 40th birthday party a year or two ago. Amazingly. So
that's what I was going to ask you, that what do we take away from this so we don't make those mistakes? And you're saying, hey, you know what, Andrew? Maybe it's not really a mistake. Maybe what we should take away from it is that these guys need to sometimes focus on their business. They can't come up with every idea and jump on that and actually continue to be a thriving company.
I could say it, Andrew, but I really don't believe it.
You don't believe it. You still think it when something this spectacular comes along, you have to.
It was huge. It was the personal computer industry. Silicon Valley basically sprung from that. It was just amazing.
All right. I want to, before I go, just tell people to go to your website, because one of the fun parts of your website is you actually have these documents to see the check that Steve Jobs signed over, and then your signature and Ed's signature underneath it, to see the original documents for Pixar, to see your interests on there. It's one of the most fun personal sites that I've seen. Usually I see a personal site that's designed to sell one aspect of an entrepreneur and to promote him that way, to but I just see your whole personality in it, and for some reason it's not – there it is. It's alvyray.com.
That's right.
And we were so proud of ourselves for finding your email address and finding your contact information, and then I realized you have it up on your site.
That's right.
No wonder all these kooks are emailing you and telling you you're wrong about this and that. It's because your email is available to anyone.
That's what it's for. I don't have to read them, right?
You don't have to respond to them all. Well, thank you for doing this interview, and I hope that if people do email you, they find that contact info and just say what I keep saying, which is thanks for doing this interview and for sharing this story. It's great for entrepreneurs like me to hear the story of how you built this tremendous company that really lived up to this vision that was huge. It wasn't a small vision. It was a huge one that took decades to put together, and look at what you've built.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah, you can say it. You can say as much as you want.
You know, the way I formulate Moore's Law is that anything good about computers gets an order of magnitude better every 5 years. Mm-hmm. That's a revolutionary speed. Every 5 years, 10x. Since 1965, when Moore's Law was a factor of one, we're now almost at 10 billion x, 10 billion times better than in 1965. That's the revolution that drives all of this. People who can see, the reason we call it an order of magnitude rather than a factor of 10 is because you can't see beyond an order of magnitude change. If you can, you can probably make $1 billion. Not only is it hard to look forward, but it's hard to look back. I notice when I'm talking to younger people, such as yourself, I can see their eyes glaze over when I tell them about, you know, 10,000 times slower than me. So what? You know, my world started at 1 billion X. Who cares what it was like before? So, what can you do with 1,000x more? Moore's Law is still alive and well. It's still going out there. 15 years from now, everything will be 1,000 times better. 1,000 times smaller, 1,000 times cheaper, 1,000 times more horsepower. It'll be better. If you can see beyond one, two, three orders of magnitude, there's $1 billion waiting for you.
So what can you do?
Let's try. So what? I guess one point I wanted to make was I got one glimpse beyond an order of magnitude, right? Because I was so focused, I and my colleagues were so focused on making that first movie, we were actually able to see out two orders of four orders of magnitude, and we are great successes because of that. But I missed a lot of other things that were over those same horizon. Google, for example. What an easy idea. I couldn't, since I started, you know, I want to hold up my phone here. Just try to imagine this thing 1,000 times better.
Yeah.
People today are born into this, but this is going to be old and clumsy.
What do you think will happen when that's 1,000 times better, that cell phone?
I don't know. I was trying to think about it the other day. I was talking to a bunch of entrepreneurs in New Mexico, and I said, can you imagine when this thing is 1,000 times better, faster? You know, it will all fit in a button, say. The camera and everything will fit in a button. What about the display? Well, maybe it's on your clothes, or you walk into a room and something detects the button is there and pops up a virtual display. Somehow the display has been taken care of. I don't know. It's hard, but you try to come up with exercises to make people start thinking about it. I can imagine, like, this, you're going to make a video out of this interview. I think today when you click on a video, it still takes time to load, right? Give me 1,000x, it's instantaneous.
Right. Probably
the whole movie at movie resolution will be instantaneous at 1,000x. I'm not positive of that, but all the glitter in video games should go away finally. They just aren't fast enough yet to do correct anti-aliasing. We know how to do, we solved that problem, those problems years ago, but not if you have to come up with a new frame every 30th of a second. But that'll happen with 1,000x. So I can pick off these things that I know will get better with 1,000x, but there's some big ideas out there that I know I haven't got a clue about. I have to go and think about it. I haven't got the tools for it.
And that's the challenge for us, not how to make the next app for the next version of the iPhone. But if we want that truly revolutionary business or that truly revolutionary idea, we need to think 1,000 times more, order of magnitude forward. With that tool, not with the next version of our OS, but with that power, what can we build?
Right.
And work towards that. And that's what you did. And that's the big takeaway for me anyway from Pixar.
And what's magic about our times is you can still get somewhere by imagining what might be beyond the next order of magnitude barrier, because Moore's law is still not. Gordon Moore himself said so last year, I think. His chips are going 3D, I think. Now they keep every time we think we're going to hit a wall of Moore's law, boop, the engineers break through and we get another 10, 20.
It was just on Hacker News today. I saw some entrepreneurs saying, join our startup. We're about to apply to Y Combinator with a 3D idea, and we need your help. So they're on there.
Yeah. It's going to be fun to watch. Anyhow, well, I've had a lot of fun in my life and a lot of fun with this interview. Thank you.
Thank you for doing this interview. I hope I get to meet you in person and to just say, again, thank you for doing this in person.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you all for being a part of it.